You're listening to Distraction Therapy with Rob Watson. Conversations about how we find meaning in our lives and what it's like to be part of a meta-modern world. Hello, this is Distraction Therapy with Rob Watson, and it's a very pleasant morning here in Leicester, and I'm sitting outside of the coffee shop today with Ryan Clayton.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very good.
Now, we're just warming up a little bit. I mean that in terms of mentally, because it's a Saturday morning. Well, I am anyway. I mean, I can't speak for Ryan, but it's...
I'm always warmed up, Rob.
Yes, but the caffeine will kind of start to kick in soon. And we usually start by asking, what have you been up to?
Yeah, I never look forward to this question because it's always the same. I've been reading a lot. Oh, I went to the cinema to see the new Doctor Strange film.
That gives us something to talk about. So I went to see that the other day as well.
Oh, did you? What did you think? Because I thought it was really good.
Do you want to do this now or leave it till later? Is it like a spoiler? Because there will be spoilers.
Oh, that's your call, Rob.
I know. Let's do it now. So, since you're kind of so enthused by it, why did you think it was good?
Because it was just daft.
That was my view when I came out of it as well.
I always love these films a lot more when they embrace a lot of the silliness that comes along with the superhero concept in general, and the fact that you shouldn't really be limited to unnecessary realism. Like, a lot of people say a lot of really great things about the first Iron Man movie, but... I'm sort of very not cold on it, but I think it's an okay film. But I think this end of the spectrum, where you get somebody like Sam Raimi, who is just going absolutely mental and doing all sorts of strange stuff with, you know, magicians fighting with musical notes to Danny Elfman's score.
That was the sequence, I think, that that really won me over. Because that was great, because that was the point where he started to realise that he felt more confident with being... It was much more comic book in that sense. So you almost expected the zaps and the wows to come out on this, the old Batman-style stuff. So.
And it comes to the same kind of level of, like, almost like a formalist approach of playing with the form of a film a little bit, because you've got a musical score in all of these films, but in that, to make it then explicit and to have it become an integral part of a story beat, of which is already quite strange.
That never happens, does it? You know, cinema doesn't really... That is it extra-diegetic and intra-diegetic, I think the phrase is, diegetic music. And the music is usually contained outside of the narrative and the world of experience of the characters. But this was the point where there was, like, this crossover between them. It was interesting that it picked up... Was it Beethoven's Fifth that it was being... mashed up.
Oh, you're more cultured than me. I didn't recognize. Oh my god, yeah, it was. But no, that's
apologies for anybody who's a fan of Beethoven.
No, but stuff like that is so much more interesting, because I remember, you know, the first Doctor Strange film, where all of the magic is still, like, they're trying to ground it in something real and in science and, you know, the mirror dimension and all of its, like, geometry and stuff. And then in this one...
They've just let go of all of that.
Yeah, you've just got... Well, it's magic.
It was a romp, yeah.
Yeah, we can do what we want because it's magic.
Well, we've got these digital effects and it's like, can we really just use them? And you know, and just have fun with them. I thought it was good fun, and I actually thought I can't remember the actor's name, the Red Witch or whatever she's called. I
don't pay that Scarlet much. Witch the Scarlet Witch, Elizabeth Olsen. That's, yeah,
it was great as an antagonist.
Yeah,
I thought that was really an interesting dynamic to go down, which was just, you know, this really strong motivation. For, you know, obsessive motivation for something which wasn't about taking over the universe.
No.
This was, you know, I've sat through so much kind of fantasy stuff recently, and you get this a lot in Doctor Who. The whole of reality is at risk. It's like, well, where do you go after that in storytelling terms?
Yeah.
You know, you've got to keep it grounded to some degree.
Well, that was what was very interesting about it, because, A, you know, the villain is a lot more interesting because it's a character that you've grown to know over several films, and it's somebody that you care about dealing with the trauma that they've gone through in all of these recent things. So it felt like a crescendo of a lot of storylines that had been going along, which kept it very grounded emotionally, because that's something that a lot of people can relate to, is attempting to deal with trauma and how you face that. But then set across this massive canvas of a multiverse that could, you know, in somebody else's hands be just ridiculous and written off almost immediately, because there's nothing about that that's even remotely relatable.
I think I read some reviews, not many, and they were a bit po-faced about it and said, you know, it's a bit too bonkers. And I thought, you're kind of missing the point.
Mm.
You know, it is, that's the whole point of it. It is, you know, it's taken the comic book aesthetic and it said, can we push this? And can we push it away from realism?
Yeah.
I mean, there's an element to it, which is, you know, you always say the kind of emotional realism. I just found it kind of, it, at some point, you know, the moments where it turned into, if you like, a zombie movie were just, you know, and I hate zombie movies, but even I was kind of infused yeah. by that. So I was like, okay, you're really having fun with this. Mm. And it was done so well, it didn't have to foreground itself, it just kept it moving along.
Yeah.
And it's like a hint.
Yeah, every time.
Like a knowing look.
Yeah, like every 15 minutes, some new concept is thrown out to be played with and then moved on from again. Like, there's that great scene where he gets captured in one of the universes by the Illuminati, and they introduce a ton of characters, and the audience, I don't know what it was like when you went to see it, but the audience in my cinema was going crazy, like cheering, clapping, like, woo! Which I hate, but it was quite fun.
There was a buzz at that point. Yeah, I don't know why.
Where they introduce all of these characters to kind of like, what's the best way to say it? To, like, placate these sort of fanboy expectations of they're going to introduce all the characters that we love.
But what I loved about it, and this is yeah. a major, major spoiler, so switch off for a second if you don't want to. You then go and kill them all. And the way that yeah. they were, it was like, finally, these superheroes aren't omnipotent. They can be... Well, you know, yeah, dealt with.
That's what I loved about it. It's like they introduced all of these...
And everybody was like, whoa, what's going on? I could see people sitting in the cinema yeah. going, oh my God, you know.
Like they introduced all of these characters to get a buzz out of everyone, and then immediately they went, no, we're going to kill them now.
Yeah.
In really brutal ways. Like the the bit where Black Bolt dies, where it's like, oh, he could kill you with a whisper from his mouth. And she just turns around and goes, what mouth?
And he kills himself.
And he screams and blows the back of his head open. I just thought, oh... This, he knows what he's doing.
So why is that touched a nerve? So what's you know, it's in terms of its resonance. So spoilers over now. We won't give any more details away. wait until it comes out on DVD or whatever. But it's what's resonant about that? Why do you think it took that particular twist and turn?
I think for me,
because you can't describe it as sincere.
No, it felt a little mean-spirited at times, that moment in particular. But I think it was it never strayed away from what I always think is most important when it comes to these, what are essentially popcorn movies. And you can describe a lot of superhero comic book, a lot of them, in the same way. It's popcorn fare in the same sense that it's almost throwaway entertainment. And it never strayed away from the sense of fun that should come along with these characters and these concepts. In the same way that another film that I really loved from the Marvel stuff was Eternals, but it didn't have that same sense of fun. When I was watching this, I never sat there bored. I never sat there thinking, oh, okay, where's this going now? It was always just on to the next thing.
It's another fairly long film as well, isn't it? You know, it's
well, that was one of the things that I was also going to say. It didn't felt needlessly long, as opposed to like the Batman, which was like 3 hours long and quite dour. I mean, that's a long time to sit in a film that that actively wants to make you depressed. But this film felt quite lean in comparison because it was only 2 hours.
I'm trying to find the name because I want to get it right. The Mike Myers thing on Netflix, The Pentaverist. It seems to have bombed with people. I really like it.
I can't say I've seen it.
It's based on this idea of a kind of an Illuminati type secret organization, and it's just full of these really gaudy, crass characters that Mike Myers kind of does well. And I think it's one of his best things he's done for a long time. Mm. It's full of the basic, you know, the fart gags and everything. And I've only got up to episode 4, I think, so I need to watch the rest of it. And I'm going to sit down and do that maybe later. But it's again, it was just this kind of, ironic but goofy.
Yeah,
that's not the world's worst word to use about comedy is zany. I've used that phrase, you know, but it's like, no, it's a bit goofy is about as far as I can go to, and it's like kind of okay. It's like it's fun, and I think a lot of people get really serious about these things and expect that there somehow should be some kind of profound existential meaning within it. It's like, no, it's just knockabout, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a time and a place. Like, I mean, I love all movies. I mean, I feel like we've talked about like Tarkovsky films before in the past, but you don't go, and the majority of people don't go to a Marvel movie. They're not massively successful because they're existentialist art house movies that tell you something very important about the human condition.
100 times the budget of those movies.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because you don't need a massive budget to tell that kind of a story. But what's interesting about the Doctor Strange movie in particular is it almost felt like somebody going, okay, well, we've got this massive budget. How can we really make the most of it? Like, how are we going to splash out on these massive visual effects and really make people say, oh, okay, like do things with them that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do otherwise?
Well, is it What Dreams May Come, one of the kind of the Robin Williams film, which was one of the ones that used digital effects, is a kind of palette box, paint box, and it had these large sequences in there which were based around, it's like one of the first times that Photoshop was used. You know, it was the use of images as a kind of creating a virtual environment, but it wasn't a realistic environment, it was an impressionistic environment. And for me, it was like it was actually a return to that kind of a way of you've got this, a lot of stuff that in is about using fantasy but in a realistic way, whereas this kind of didn't. And it blended so many different elements that it's very, very difficult to unpick the streams, the threads. You know, what's the fantastical? What's the, if you like, the grounded fantastical? What's the ungrounded fantastical? I'm sure you could come up with like a taxonomy of all the variations of how this stuff's used. And then just pushes it through without any break.
Yeah, well, again, that was another one of the things that I liked. And it's one of the things I think is the great strength of the superhero concept in general. Is that it's not really defined by genre in any traditional sense, in the way that, like, you know, the concept of a detective is. You can place superheroes into any genre and it works. So it's really nice now to see them start to play with, to push outside of the comfort zone and the kind of genre that they created. Like, you've got the really massive, like, science fiction soap operas playing in, like, Guardians of the Galaxy. Doctor Strange really lent into the fantastical horror stuff to the point where, like, it was actually very effective as well as, like, a, you know, a kid's first horror movie, because there's a lot of stuff in there that you look at and go, whoa, okay, I'm not sure I'd let my kid see that, but... And now, like... I don't know, it's such a nice change of pace from the very, like, colourless first outings of all of these characters.
I think one of the things they've benefited from is the move away from the American supremacy. And it was ironic that the kind of the character that was, if you like, what they call the MacGuffin in the film, was this young woman who could travel across the multiverse. And her name was America, which is a Latin name, but it's, you know, the the fact that it was almost as if it was like a proxy to say, we need to save America. And the hero who was saving America wasn't of a heroic nature. In fact, he was the antithesis of that. He was the anti-hero to some extent. Doctor Strange isn't the person. He does the right thing eventually, but he kind of has to be compelled to do it rather than being the person up front who says, we're marching into danger because we're doing the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, that was, again, like, he spends a lot of the film struggling with that idea of, oh, what if I'm not the good guy? Because you have all of these other versions of Doctor Strange in all of these other realities that are just really horrible people and are willing to do absolutely anything to achieve...
And you take it as far as you can go to the point where there's no other choice that you can make. And that might just be that you're the one left with the, you know, the mouldy baked potato in your hand that you can't get rid of, and you've got to eat it. It's like, I'll do a film based around that, you know, passing responsibility. But you get to the point where all you can do is you can't absolve yourself of any responsibility, and you've got to act and step up and do it. Mm. And that's, you know, that kind of was played out in a number of ways. He tried different permutations of it, and then eventually he had to come down to doing one particular thing on each option. On each, you know, that's the interesting thing about those kind of infinite universe movies and stories. And there's, you know, there's plenty of them. You know, there's alternate realities and the Matrix and everything is they're all predicated on this idea that would you be different, or would you end up just doing the same things over and over again if you had the opportunity to either replay your reality or to exist in an alternative reality. What would happen? You know, Back to the Future. You know, is any kind of time travel thing is based on that predicate of what would you do different? Mm. What would you be able to do different, or is there some kind of a fate to what you do?
Yeah. Well, I'm reminded of one really excellent episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation that I find myself thinking about a lot because I love Star Trek, obviously, where Captain Picard is visited by Q, and it's one of those moments where he's kind of lamenting some of the things, you know, his exuberant youth and some of the things that he did and some of the risks that he took. And Q says, well, all right, let's take you back to the past, do it like the height of your exuberant youth and some of the things that you did and got away with that you seriously regret, and let's see how you'd act differently. And then one of the really interesting aspects of that story is when he says, okay, you've gone back to the past, you've done things differently, as you now see with hindsight what you should have done. And he takes him back to the present and shows him how that would have impacted his life, and he becomes a sort of ineffectual figure that's not moved forward in his career, that's sort of always blurred into the background. And he has conversations with some of the crew, and they talk about how, you know, oh, I appreciate the fact that you want to progress in your career, but you just don't have what it takes.
It's really just a Greek tragedy, isn't it? It's just played out again. You know, these are the same stories, and they tap into that sense of, you know, kind of fate and predetermination and external control or shaping of our lives, which we're not in full awareness of or control of. It's interesting that I've watched the Picard series. I am a bit of a media... I was thinking about this, actually, this morning, thinking, I maybe need to kind of unhook a little bit from media. I've been obsessed with different stuff for years. Maybe it's time to step back from it and stop watching, you know, keeping up with these things and kind of, you know, having an awareness of them. But I don't know. It's like the number of hours I watched what kept watching Star... Because my Star Trek The Next Generation thing... I didn't want to pay for Sky, so I ended up getting it on DVD on Love Film and copying them, so I could watch them later on DVD.
I'm not sure you should be admitting that, Rob.
Well, it was like, but I remember, you know, the hours that I took in copying these things and then watching them as well, and then. I think a couple of years ago, when they came onto Netflix, I was watching them all again. And you end up binge-watching them, and you think, the things I could have done with my life other than just sitting there watching these.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's why I've never watched the Waking Dead, because like this 11 series of it. I was like, I'm not going to start getting into that.
Yeah. No. Well, I've always found that, and it came across more by accident than anything, but there's always sort of, in my media consumption, an element of focus. Like, I became obsessed with film when I was like 16, all the way through to like when I was maybe 21, and sort of watched as many films I could get my hands on. I remember most days I would sit there and do nothing but watch three or four films that I'd never seen before, like back to back, just soaking them all up. And then kind of fell out of love with that because I kind of took my interest with it as far as I could. And now, ever since then, I've been more interested in comic books and reading those. And it's one of those things where I've never been a huge fan of rewatching or rereading stuff unless it's really deeply impacted me in some way. It's always, okay, move on to what's the next thing now? What new story can I fill my mind with? What else can I, you know, pollinate my imagination with?
No, I'm the same. It's kind of, you end up with a kind of almost an expectation that you've got, you're searching for the novel or the, I mean, I don't know whether, I'm fairly basic with my media consumption. I'm not really one. I don't have a collection of art house films from the, you know, Japanese art house films from the 1970s or something like that. And nor do I have a collection of Japanese jazz records from the 1970s. And there are probably some wonderful people out there who've got that kind of interest. I'm fairly mainstream in a way. So one thing I wanted to ask you about, actually, it's a good point to shift the conversation, and I've just ordered us more coffee.
So, brilliant. So
it'll be coming in a second. Which is, if there's a project I'm involved in at the moment, or trying to start the ball rolling with, which is to look at developing an art-based radio station. But what I wanted to ask you, just for, I suppose, a one-person focus group, in terms of...
what more do you need,
if you
Rob?
Could set up a radio station... What would you, and you've got, you know, everything's, it's a blank slate. There's nobody, there's no expectations about who's involved. There's no expectations about following a format. Certainly we don't care about who the audience is. What would you want to do? Or what would you want to hear from it? What would you want it to include? How would you want it to...
That's interesting.
Do you listen to the radio? Is a good starting point.
I don't. To be honest, mainly because I never know what radio stations are good. My knowledge of radio is so limited that I feel like if I were to turn
it... So what would you be looking for? What would you want that good to be?
Well, I think to answer that question, what I would do if I had a radio show,
if you had the power,
if I had the power to sit there and make people listen to me.
Well, you're not making anybody listening to you. Just get over yourself first. It's just on in the background. Yeah. You know, we're not expecting that there's going to be an audience for this.
Yeah, I think ideally it would be a reflection of the kind of stuff that I'm interested in. So something about comic books I think would be interesting, because there's a lot of discourse that surrounds comics that is very superficial and boring. It's like, oh, this character did this in this issue, and that's like literally the extent of the discourse. So I think it would be quite good, you know, if you had like a show where
we don't do shows.
Radio.
I mean, this is the thing. Take every preconception that you have about radio and put it in the bin. So if you don't have a show, typically I'd say there are programs.
Right.
Things that you construct, artifacts that you collect and put them into some kind of order. But the idea that it might be a show has a load of baggage with it in terms of presentation and format and things like that. So what, you know, even going as far back as ditching those kind of things.
Well, one, I'd like to hear some more interesting music, because I feel like a lot of the music that you hear on the radio is, you know, top of the chart stuff. I'd quite like to hear some interesting, like, long form prog music that no one's ever heard of, like 20-minute concept songs, like, you know, science fiction soap operas played out in the kind of like abstract emotionality that music allows. Yeah, and also just people talking about comics. Prog music and
24
comics.
Hours a day.
That's what I want. Yeah, 24 hours a day of people talking about comics and stupidly long prog music that nobody listens to.
So you put the record on and then you come back to it half an hour later. It's like, what? I mean, there's a lot of that is sounds like podcasting. Is that a, you know, I have this issue about people kind of, there are some really good rate. I mean, I basically for this idea, ripping off Sound Art Radio, who people will be listening to us from this discussion in Totnes, and then also resonant stations like Resonance FM. There's a few online stations that I think are really good as well, and Threads and Melodic Distraction. And it's kind of looking at how you use the medium in a creative way in itself, rather than as a formulaic. I'm not, you know, it would probably have to include certain things that are scheduled at certain times, but how, you know, it doesn't have to be, and it can be open to. Because, you know, the technology's changed now. You know, the variety, you know, the ability to put things into a sequence via online scheduling systems are so much easier than they ever used to be. The only thing you've got to do is occasionally, on a regular basis, let the listener know which station that they're listening to. But everything else can be open and flexible about that. And it doesn't have to follow any kind of a set pattern. But that seems to be... You know, podcasting was interesting for the, you know, when it kind of first started, in terms of how people were finding the way around that, and in terms of using different approaches and different types of formats for engaging with people. So I listen to a lot of podcasts which are discussion and, if you like, forum based discussions, and I think that's perfectly valid as a way of either reusing them or setting them up in the first place to be something which can be broadcast. What's the difference these days between something which is broadcast on the, you know, from a single transmitter to a geographic area, and to if you like, point-to-point IP database-based individual media that you access via your phone or something like that? Can we play with that?
I don't know.
And what kind of... And what kind of... Back to what kind of comics and prog rock records. I wasn't expecting such a blunt answer.
Well, I think when it comes to playing with the form of radio in particular, I feel like I've not listened to enough radio to be able to correctly identify what the interesting elements are of the form. Because if you're going to play with the form of something, it would have to be the elements of the form that make radio unique. So perhaps the idea that, you know, radio is something that, like you say, is on in the background, like you're driving somewhere and you turn the radio on in the car and it just comes up, and then you can tune in the middle of the song and you turn it off when you get where you're going. So, I mean, you said something last week, or not last week, whenever we last did one of these, that was really interesting. The idea of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not computer generated, but like algorithmic, kind of like processed,
yeah,
like put in a bunch of sounds,
generative,
yeah, put in a bunch of sounds like music samples and stuff, and have like an algorithm like play with those elements,
yeah,
to the degree where you could have like years of music that is algorithmically generated, so you could tune in at any point and never hear the same thing twice, and it just shows up in the background. I'm thinking of, like, again, like, interesting artists that, like do that same kind of thing, that sit around. My friend recently told me about an interesting artist called Burial, who in his first album in particular, I think, took a bunch of like sound samples and soundscape recordings from around London when he was on the tube walking the streets and mixed them together into a kind of atmospheric music that captured what it felt like to be in London. And there's like an intense loneliness to some of his tunes, because you know it's just one guy walking around on his own through London. I think something like that would be quite interesting.
That idea comes from the work at Sound Art, which is Skylark Radio, which plays out over Dartmoor. So which I'm yet to experience. I'm dying to get up there to go for a walk in the moors to take my FM radio with me and tune in. And it uses those generative techniques. So you don't get these repeating patterns. It changes it, and Lucinda can definitely explain it much more appropriately than I can. Yeah. But I think what's interesting is, in music, I think there used to be a thing, I don't know whether it's still a common thing, Koan music, K-O-A-N, which was about that idea of taking elements and then having them to recycle, cycle through different patterns. Mm. And the variations of these patterns can be generated, four tones can generate 8 hours worth of music or something.
Something else that's also occurred to me that I think might be interesting is, because the way that I interact, I love poetry, but the way in which I interact with poetry, because I know very little about it, is I'll tend to find a poet that I think is interesting and buy just a book that contains some of their work, usually like a selected poems or complete poems of, Robert Frost, E.E. Cummings, Wilfred Owen, whatever, and flick through the book kind of reading just the random poems that catch my eye, and occasionally you'll come across something really good. So I think maybe the idea of like setting in a 2-hour slot or whatever, just to have like a bunch of poems queued up that have been read out or recorded, and then just mix them up totally at random. So, you tune in the car and you never really know what poet or what poem you're going to stumble upon. And it's constantly changing. So one moment you'll hear some First World War poetry by Wilfred Owen, and you think, wow, that's really quite impactful. And then all of a sudden, bang, next poem is something by E.E. Cummings, although I'm not quite sure how you'd record some of his stuff.
Well, you could do some Dada.
Yeah. But, something like that element of like...
So it's introducing the notion of the poetic. Mm. And this is one of the things I think, a lot of radio... So you change it from the nature of radio... and our expectation, our cultural expectations about what radio is, into something which is creative expectations about sound experience. Because it's a medium in sound, but then you introduce another element to it, which is it's a poetic experience. So what do we mean? What is that poetic experience? And there's an element to poetry which can be... which can be linked across lots of different creative forms. The poetic imagination is that element of intuitive engagement with the world and an expression, literally in poetry in words, but it could be the poetic imagination that's expressed through visual arts or through music so there's these things of, exploring this on the basis of saying, actually, there's something comes from this which we cannot indicate. Because the hardest job with this, I think, is to kind of say, well, people will ask constantly, well, what's this about? What's it for? And it's like, I can't tell you. You've got to sit and experience it. And you might not like it, or you might like it. You might get something from it, or you might not get something from it. We can't control that. And that's quite radical for people in radio terms.
Yeah.
To turn around and say, this is why one of the hardest things for this is who's the audience. So I've absolutely no idea.
Well, you'll either find one or you won't.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be, a mixture. I hope that'd be able to put together a kind of mixture of things. So in on the one hand, you would do things which you'd schedule and you'd have key times for it, rather than maybe just... there's our coffee. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just... There are advantages to modern technology of being able to just order online and get it brought to the table. That is
nice.
Better. So what was my train of thought? Yeah, this, just trying to explore and going beyond prog rock and discussions. What kind of discussions? So having a discussion, how would you feel if you were having to chaperone, moderate, facilitate a discussion? How would you feel that? What would you want to listen to as a kind of an engaging discussion?
Well, I'll tell you what I wouldn't want to hear. Because one of the things that's always really annoyed me about radio is particularly the presenters and their overly false enthusiasm for pretty much everything. It's loud and it's obnoxious. I think what would be more interesting would just be a couple of people sitting down and having a chat about something in a way that isn't overly manufactured or scripted. These conversations I think I quite enjoy. I think it would be quite good if you just got a couple of people sat down in a room and you gave them a prompt or something. I don't know, you made them read this. They come from different backgrounds, could be two people, could be five people. You gave them a prompt because they all come from different backgrounds. They'll all react to that prompt in different ways and see what kind of ideas that sparks, and just have them sit there.
It's like a reflective exercise.
Mm.
Rather than, I think you're right. One of my criticisms of radio is that there's how do you pronounce that? Is like there's just too much personality out there, and everything's dependent on somebody's. Hey, I'm best friends with this, and I went and saw this, and I did this, and aren't I wonderful? And I'm your. You know, there's an archetypal role. Something I've wanted to write for a long time, which is about archetypal roles within radio. And particularly as they're applied to community radio, because there's a lot of people come to community radio and think that they have to imitate those roles that they've heard on Radio 2 or Capital or Smooth or something like that. And actually, you don't. You can facilitate something completely different.
Yeah.
But the archetype of the personality, the best friend, the font of knowledge, it runs right the way throughout radio, and it's artificially created.
Yeah, because I get the impression that whenever you listen to these things, everybody's so trying so desperately to come across as somebody that you would like.
You would idealise.
Yeah. I want to hear somebody on the radio that I wouldn't like.
Tune into LBC. There's plenty of people on there. They have a good selection of people.
Somebody that has absolutely no personality. Yeah. That would be fantastic.
Well, that's an opening for me.
Yeah, just get somebody to sit there and drone on in a very misanthropic, pessimistic sort of way.
And that's the interesting thing. I mean, that's the interesting thing about the poetic, because, and really until we've lost that common culture of listening to the spoken word. You get it on Radio 4 and Radio 3 are probably about the only places that do it, but they've started to do it. They've compartmentalized it. I don't feel it organic. I feel it's a bit forced in terms of the way that they utilize those voices, and it becomes a bit more, you're keeping some good actors in work by giving them these little voiceover jobs doing reading poems. I like, there's a program on Radio 3, which I haven't listened to for a while, but I used to listen to a lot, which is Words and Music. Used to be on Sundays, and it would be a mixture of poetry and music.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, it was good because it was like there was no presenter. There was nobody telling you what was coming up next. There was nobody sitting there saying, reading out, so you listen to the Radio 3 breakfast program and they're reading out tweets and messages from listeners, and I'm like, that's why I stopped listening to it, because I don't want to be told things that I'm part of something. I just want to listen to this for itself.
I mean, also, who cares what people are tweeting?
Well,
people
go on Twitter.
Tweet all kinds of crap.
Go on Twitter if you want to follow that.
Yeah. What's just occurred to me, I thought would be quite interesting, is if you got a bunch of experts or semi-experts in something, and you told them, okay, next week we're going to talk about this, and they went away and they prepared for it, And then they show up and you say, actually, we're talking about something completely different. You can't use any of your prepackaged talking points.
You can only do that once, really, yeah. Can't you? But having prepackaged talking points is really fascinating, because most people's media training, when I've worked with academics and things and you know, kind of industry experts and stuff, is 5 minutes on the local BBC radio station. And you answer, you know, your media training, speaking to journalists, is to say the same thing three times in three different ways, but you're saying the same thing and no variation away from that. Whereas when with community radio, you've got so much time that you can fill. So when we you know, you can listen to long and extended mixes, and you can talk about things. So one of the good things about podcasting is there's no, you know, we're keeping this to an hour, because that's, you know, reasonable, but we could go on for
five.
Yeah, I'm not there. How much? What would I be like after 5 hours worth of drinking coffee? It's, but you know, so that we've got the possibility of changing the form, changing the format. But one of the things I kind of connect this to, and kind of making it into, if you like, hopefully offering this as a kind of meta modern aesthetic for how you do it and process for how you do it, is that you change the form. You change the format and the process, you change the meanings. But yeah. And if you change the meanings, you change the form and the process. So there's something that, one of the things I'd like to do, something which is more emergent, which isn't so predictable, which allows people a bit of space to, even if it takes 16 hours of listening to cows in a field. I'm being horribly narrow in the way that I describe these things. I like sound art, but I'm not well informed about them. And I think one of the things, and also for it to form a sense of it being a learning community, that you can use sound and you can use the medium of radio in a way which changes your perspective and the way that you engage with people. I'm trying to figure out how to put that into a license application, you know, because they want to say, well, what are you going to do? Well, we're going to play a load of random, fairly random stuff that, you know, you shouldn't devalue either.
Yeah, I think I think a good mix of stuff would be nice as well. Like if you found, let's say, you know, 5-6 people who were really interested in a bunch of different things, and you just said, all right, you've got an hour to talk about what you enjoy or just, you know, to do whatever with it. You could have an artist who's really interested in using sound as a medium to get things across, or you could just have someone who's an expert in, I don't know, 70,
philosophy, or yeah, philosophy, literature, or
philosophy,
theater,
comic books. Cinema, I wonder yeah, who you'd find for that. But yeah, but you know, anything like that. So to the point where you could tune in, and somebody who's really interested in and passionate about something is doing something that they're really interested in, passionate about, because that interest and especially the passion is always contagious.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's the you hit on something, which is you bring in a community of people together to share the things that they care about. But what I'm also keen is that it points forward to something new that emerges from the practice. So you might bring things that you have prior learning of, prior relationships with, but when you put it into the mix of things over time, it will kind of develop into a kind of a different direction. So one of the challenges would be people's preconceptions of what radio and radio presentation and program making is about, but also in terms of preconceptions of what our culture is, which is often highly compartmentalized. So there are multiple cultures, and in a multi-ethnic urban city, often they can get compartmentalized and narrowed down to faith or ethnicity, you know, other factors. And there are many other ways. I'm kind of, how can we take all of that, mix it all together, mash it up a bit, and then what will it lead to in terms of something that might be new, that there's a kind of more blended experience comes out of this, rather than a resting on what we all already know.
Mm. Well, I don't know. You're the radio expert, so I leave it in your capable hands.
You know, anybody wants to get in touch with me and kind of help me work this through, because I don't want to spend ages thinking about it, or do just want to bang in an application.
Sometimes that's the best place to be. I mean, if you know too much about the process, you just sort of end up falling you just end up falling into those same traps. It's like I'm reminded of something that Danny Boyle once said about making films, and how he thinks that, you know, his earlier films are much more interesting, like, you know, Shallow Grave and Trainspotting, because he didn't know anything about filmmaking. He just sort of set out to make the thing that he wanted to make, and he made it.
Yeah.
Whereas now, when he approaches a film, he's so totally aware of the tradition and how things are done that it's hard to escape that and to do something genuinely new and interesting.
So that,
which
that,
I think is quite interesting.
And that's a really great ethos to you know, your lack of knowledge and awareness and affinity with radio is a great asset, because then as long as you're prepared to say, okay, there's certain things that you have to do it responsibly, and to do it within the law. And however, apart from that, all bets are off.
Exactly. Because that's when the really interesting stuff emerges. I think, again, Orson Welles, listening to him talk about the process of making Citizen Kane, it was very much similar. You know, all of the groundbreaking stuff that occurred during that film boils down to, oh, well, we just didn't know we weren't allowed to do that.
You give me these examples to compare this with, which are awesome.
The awesome Wells of the next generation, Rob.
Yeah, I'll need to get a big glass of brandy and a huge cigar or something and put on another £400 or something just to compete with that. It's fascinating. So in terms of what do you look for and would hope that you might pick up from in terms of a sense of belonging or community, that this might potentially, you know, what should we be trying to feed into this in terms of getting people involved and how they operate, you know, how much of their egos need to be parked outside the door?
I think the main thing would simply be, and again, you know, I touched on this earlier, is giving people space to explore things that they're passionate about or interested in but might not necessarily know a lot about or have explored, giving people room to grow.
I'm taking a photo, go on, like while you're posing.
room to grow, room to explore and share the things that they care about.
That's an interesting word to use, because care is one of those things which is on multiple levels. Is an emergent. This ties in with that metamodern sincerity, I think, which is care. When you look at what people care about and what people care for, and what people's experiences of, you know, what do you care? So I ask you, what do you care about? What do you care for? That's a real challenge to ask people, I think.
Yeah, that's a hard question.
Well, most radio is on the basis of, we're telling you what you should think about, what you should care about. Have you seen this latest stuff on social media that's going around, these jokes, you know, these stories in the newspapers? Have you, you know, we're so knowledgeable about 1970s, you know, British rock bands or something like that. And it's kind of all, you know, we're so in tune with the latest music scenes. But when you unpick it, you realise that there's a whole industry of stuff there. And then you have got to ask the question, who is actually caring about this? Just because it's on the radio and somebody's telling you that you think you ought to care about it. I mean, my personal, I've never cared about Radiohead. So, you know, listening to a lot of stuff with people going on about Radiohead, I just don't care. And I love being able to say to people, I don't care. Yeah. There's millions of things I don't care about. Yeah. But it's harder to define what it is I do care about. I suppose at this moment, it's coffee and conversation.
Well, it's difficult as well, because one of the things that I think is occasionally overlooked is that care is... what's the best way of phrasing this? It's not simply, you know, when you care for something, you're looking after it, you're interested in it, but you're also sitting there and yeah, is
the listening to John Vivekie's lectures has been really useful, and the element that I understand from Heidegger, and you can correct me and explain this, is the difference between having and being. So the Cartesian model was about you have certain characteristics. You have a sense of consciousness which fills a function, but that is different from a sense of being and a sense of something where you feel you're, if you like, fulfilled or at, you know, it's something which is at the metamodern critique is that there's something that is absent from modern life, which is we focus too much on having physical things, resources, and we don't think enough about being and those moments and, you know, kind of resolving that existential crisis. You know, so it's almost as if you can say, well, having an existential crisis becomes a badge of honor for people because I've got something. You know, I'm pigeonholed now as somebody who's got, I've had an existential crisis. Okay, you've had something, but what did you learn from that? How did it transform you, and what have you become in the process of that?
Yeah, well, it's like intelligence is always a good example because there's a massive focus on having intelligence and remembering facts and being able to, even in academia, and being able to cite the right sources and rattle off the correct facts, as opposed to the process of growing and learning and discovery.
And being a fulfilled and valuable member of a community. So being rather than having. You know, what tells you that you are a valued member of a community? Is it your status? Is it the things that you accrue? Is it the wealth that you accumulate? Or is it the way that you feel? Do you belong? Are you cared for? Do you care for others? So that's a different set of questions. I mean, ancient questions,
yeah.
But they're a different set of questions than the ones that tend to dominate how we think about things.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of Aristotle's notion of happiness and eudaimonia. It's not just this, you know, it's not a fleeting feeling of joy. In Aristotle's hands, happiness becomes a kind it becomes human flourishing. You're happy when you're flourishing, and you might not always be experiencing joy, but you're achieving a kind of potential there. You're constantly growing and reaching for something.
And that would be really interesting to try and set up a situation that is the social benefit of what you're trying to do.
Mm.
That's, you know, when you look at something and you're asking the question, not what people to get for it. It's that, I always forget his name. The art and crafts guy in the 19th century. I can never remember it. I've got this mental block about his name. Really important. Anyway, he says, you know, it's not what you get for something. It's what you become.
Mm.
And that idea of significantly, we're going to get blasted out by the street cleaner.
I think we might be, yeah.
We might have to just kind of let it pass for a minute. But the... I'll record the sound for a second.
Yeah, don't say anything too interesting.
Yeah, there's the street cleaner going past. And
very facile attempt at cleaning the street there.
He's got a constant job, hasn't he? You know, it's like it's out 24 hours a day. For some people, you know, even when you go to the bin, there's rubbish outside the bin, but not in the bin. You know, we live in a city that just, you know, it's like, don't get me started. I'll save that for when I phone into LBC.
We're sitting next to the Contemporary. That was what was interesting about going to the Contemporary the last time we were here and seeing that, I don't know his name, but he'd done a lot of stuff that was like snapshots of Leicester and capturing how it felt to be there in a very real, unmanufactured way. Like, a lot of it was made with refuse cardboard and like cigarettes stuck to the bottom and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it's I think for me it's partly about how do we engender a sense of confidence about, we need to dump, sorry to friends who do this, marketing and PR and all that kind of stuff, because it's just, soul-destroying. And I mean that genuinely from the bottom of my soul, that when you're looking at media that's used in order to sell you something or to... It's not part of a creative expression.
No.
It's just purely something which is designed to present something in a way which makes it palatable.
As someone who works in PR, I can fully confirm that to be true.
You know, the process.
It is. Yeah, no, it is soul crushing.
And there's no, it, you know, it's kind of, you know, maybe it's the world that we live in, and you've got to do a certain amount of it. Like we've got to clean the bins, but I don't want to put it there as the, you know, the highlight of anybody's life or week. You know, what are you doing this week? Well, I'm flicking through magazines that are trying to sell me just stuff. Now, don't get me wrong, I like design. And I like things that are created and have an aesthetic sensibility, which is interesting in its own terms, whether it's mass-produced or whether it's... So I'll go into a shop and look at trainers, you know, and I know the culture around that, you know, £300 trainers, but aesthetically, they do look interesting. It's a design model.
But what's also interesting about marketing and PR is the kind of insidious stealth nature of it. I know several times as part of my job doing PR, you write these press releases that are designed exclusively so people can sell you something, and you send that press release out to a bunch of journalists, and then that piece that you've written with that intent solely in mind ends up in a newspaper disguised as an article about something interesting buried, you know, on page 5, page 12 or whatever. And it works its way in there. And if you're just flicking through the newspaper, people buy the newspaper to stay informed. But that's not...
It's corrupted the process.
Exactly, yeah.
And the separation between news and press and PR has become...
Well, it's non-existent.
Yeah. So... Couple of minutes left. Anything you're doing this week that you're looking forward to?
Let me think. No.
Well, you've got a pile of books that you're going to work through.
I do, yeah. I've just been handed by you, Rob, a bunch of Philip K. Dick books that I'm interested
in reading.
Which you
got from the little library on Foss Road.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. Couple of interesting comic books that I've got queued up to read this weekend about trauma, written by a guy called Tom King, who's an interesting figure because I believe he was part of the CIA and has had to deal with his fair amount of like dealing with fairly traumatic wartime experiences, and a lot of that makes it through into his work. I started reading last night the first half of a book called The Omega Men, which is basically a member of the Green Lanterns, basically a space cop, goes into this area of space that they've previously not been allowed into, and he gets kidnapped by a bunch of radicals, and it's all about like the violence that's inflicted upon the people by the radicals and by the power structures, and trying to figure out who the real bad guys are and if even such a label correctly applies, and how the regular people of this star system and all these planets deal with the power games and the violence that's going on around them.
Just read the news.
Whoa.
What's going on in the world? It might be a bit easier to do it in that form. Right. Okay. What's the best way that people can get in contact with you?
I'm on Twitter under at Clayton Comics with an X on the end.
And I'm Rob W. Media on Twitter and Instagram, and the website is robwattonmedia.net. Thanks as ever to Leicester Community Radio and Sound Art Radio, and we'll speak to you soon. You've been listening to Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson. Find out more at robwattonmedia.net. Or follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Rob W. Media.